Welcome to this Financial Advisor Podcast, a weekly podcast where I speak to leading financial advisors. My guest today is Devon Card, a director and shareholder at Crewe Invest. Welcome, Devon.
Thanks for having me, Eleanor.
Let's just start with Crewe Invest. It's one of the few local companies with the FPI-approved professional practice accreditation. Can you explain what this is and how Crewe qualifies for it?
Sure. The FPI is the Financial Planning Institute of Southern Africa. They are the recognized professional association for financial planners. So being recognized as a FPI-approved professional practice involves going through a whole stringent accreditation process conducted by the FPI themselves. It reinforces that our standards in terms of knowledge, expertise, and ethical conduct are amongst the best in the country, and the accreditation just underlines our commitment to upholding the highest professional standards as well as incorporating international best practices as well.
What's keeping your clients up at night currently?
While I'd like to say it's just the poor returns in the market that our clients are worried about, unfortunately, it seems to be going a bit deeper than that. You know, while it isn't everyone, there seems to be a growing concern among our clients as to whether or not there's actually a future for them here in this country. So while we at Crewe don't actually believe that the country's headed that way, there is unfortunately such a big presence of bad news thrown around the internet, TV and radio, it's difficult to blame someone for feeling that way about the country.
Are you finding that you're having to advise on financial immigration at all?
Yeah, so that specifically in the last 18 months, that's been one of the biggest questions that have come up in our reviews with clients. Clients, not necessarily that they want to leave the country right away. They just want to understand what their options are around financially immigrating from South Africa. So yes, we're definitely seeing a growing concern and consideration to financial immigration.
Especially in this environment, what does it take for you as a financial advisor to build long-term relationships with your clients?
I think it comes down to one thing, and that's trust. I would say this is the key thing to a healthy long-term relationship between the client and the advisor. We come across too many clients who've had or heard of a friend or a family member having a bad experience with a so-called, you know, broker trying to sell them unnecessary policies and masking it as advice. So us as advisors need to show our clients, through consistently advising them in their best interest, that they can trust us. Once this trust is built, this is when you can definitely have a long, successful relationship with your client.
And how do you build trust with them?
It's a difficult question, and it's not one that's tangible. You know, so each client is different. So some clients feel that they can trust their advisors when there's consistent service, you know, responding to emails timeously, making sure that, you know, you answer their questions and don't try and hide anything from them. I think to try and get across to the client that you have their best interests at heart, that's the biggest step to building that trust with the client.
On a slightly different slant, this is Women's Month, and what would you say are some of the wealth-building challenges that women face?
This is an interesting one, and there have been quite a few studies in this regard, and one of the recent ones shows that women still allow their partners or spouses to take charge of household finances. In fact, the study showed that 55% of millennial women in long-term relationships or marriages did not actually get involved in the couple's money management and were happy to leave the job to their male partners. Another challenge is that women tend to save rather than invest. They tend to want to preserve their capital rather than pursuing investment growth strategies. And one of the other points that came out of the study is that women are often the primary carers for the children, or the aged parents or other family members, and this can actually affect their ability to generate income and ultimately save.
Just given that stat, would you say that women are more risk-averse than men, given that they'd rather save than invest?
Yes, yeah. So, you know, it comes from that whole gender gap where, you know, women are told that they have to, you know, save and preserve their capital, whereas the men are kind of encouraged to go out and invest. So I would definitely think that these stats kind of lend to that factor that women are potentially more risk averse.
There's a lot of deeper issues here.
Yeah.
So how should women address these challenges, or at least attempt to?
Firstly, a woman should definitely try and make it a priority to shoulder the financial burden together with their partners, regardless of who earns what in the relationship. In the study, 20% of women will actually find themselves solely responsible for the family's finances at some point in their lives, whether it's through death, divorce, or other circumstances. And it makes sense for them to be involved from the very beginning. So although women tend to invest less often, they actually make better investors than men. They transact less often, follow advice, and are more likely to stick to a long-term plan. Women should therefore be encouraged to invest more aggressively for the long term rather than opting for just a cautious saving strategy. And in terms of their role as mothers and carers, women should think very carefully before entirely giving up their careers to have children. With the speed at which technology is advancing, coupled with the unemployment rate at the moment, women face serious challenges when attempting to re-enter the workforce after giving birth and taking a few years off to look after their children.
One of your other focus points is employee benefit solutions. Regarding company pension and provident funds, I'd imagine many employees sign up for them, and besides receiving a yearly statement, that's their only involvement until they leave the company or retire. How much say can employees actually have over their funds and how they're invested, and how involved should they be?
Okay, so luckily the regulations are changing slightly in this space and enabling employees of a pension provident fund to become more involved and engaged in their pension fund. Whereas a while ago what used to happen, you would have someone enter a big corporate, they know they're going to work there for the next 30 to 35 years, and they get faced with a simple decision like would they like to invest in a conservative or aggressive fund for their pension fund. And unfortunately, without proper education, stats say that most of the people entering into that pension fund took the cautious option. Unfortunately, if that's the option that you choose, you could be faced in a situation where you have more than or less than half of what someone has if they pick the aggressive option. So, luckily, as I said, regulations have changed. There's something called Regulation 37 now, where there's a default strategy that has to be put into place for all pension funds. And the trustees have to make sure that these default strategies are reasonably priced, appropriate, and well communicated to all the members. That strategy is kind of there for any member who doesn't really want to choose the investment strategy that they want to be in. But what we found now with all these pension and provident fund schemes is that there's actually a lot of choice to the actual employees themselves on an individual basis. And we really encourage these members to really understand what their options are and assess their own personal financial situation before selecting the investment strategy. Because someone who is entering the marketplace at, let's say, 30, 35 years old has a completely different investment horizon to someone who's exiting the marketplace at say, 65. So, yes, while there will be default strategies put in place, there should be a whole arrangement of investment options to these employees, and they should definitely look at considering their options with an advisor who can look at their whole holistic financial plan before making that decision.
What are your biggest challenges with your clients when it comes to retirement planning?
I would say the most difficult thing that I deal with at the moment is the motivation side of things when it comes to actually saving towards your retirement. Typically, there are two main excuses that we come across from our clients. And the first one is that clients say that, look, I know I need to keep working forever, so I'm just going to work until I drop, so there's no need to really save for retirement. Or on the other side, when we show clients how much they should be saving to meet their retirement goals, it actually acts as a demotivator, and realizing that they can't save everything, they rather save nothing at all. So that's the biggest hurdle. Once we can actually motivate someone to just start saving, just get going, even if it's a small amount that they're putting away each month, what ends up happening is after a couple of years, that client sees that just by chipping away each month, they've actually accumulated a fair amount of savings. And that actually acts as a motivator. And we start seeing their behavior change towards saving. All of a sudden, they're able to find an extra couple of hundred rand a month here and there by cutting back expenses or actually realizing that retirement could be a potential goal for them. And that acts as, they become self-motivating. And that's the biggest hurdle, is to get the client to actually become motivated to save towards retirement.
So it's a bit of a snowball effect.
Yes, yeah, exactly.
You recently wrote an article for MoneyWeb on why having an emergency fund is so important. Why do we need one?
So an emergency fund, it's very important for a number of reasons. I would say the main one is that it acts as a barrier between client and debt. So, in the absence of this emergency fund, what ends up happening is when these unforeseen events happen, for example, like a vet bill, or you need new tires for your car, or even booking a last minute plane ticket, if the client doesn't have that emergency fund available, what ends up happening is the client dips into credit or takes out a personal loan to cover these costs. And again, that has a snowball effect, but in the other way, and we start building this debt to cover costs. It also, saving for an emergency fund also acts as a discipline. So someone who gets used to saving in an emergency fund, they build up this discipline, which is, an habit, and that can help towards their other financial goals, like retirement, for example.
So just how do you start saving towards such a fund?
So there are a few very simple steps that we recommend. The first one is just to find a very reliable financial institution. It could be your bank or a unit trust platform like a money market fund. Make sure that the money is very accessible. You don't want to use these accounts where the money gets locked away for 30 days or 90 days, for example. It must be a transactional account that you can access quite easily. And once you've found that institution, pick an investment strategy that is at least inflation matching, so that sits around CPI, 4.5%, 5%. So your money at least grows in line with inflation. So once you've found those two factors, the institution and the fund that you're going to invest in, it's as simple as just committing to a monthly saving that you're comfortable with. And it's always advisable to have an end goal in mind. So whether that is 3 months of your expenses, 6 months, or a full year, have that goal in mind. And once you get to that goal, then you can at least stop the debit order. And when you dip into that emergency saving account, just restart the debit order until you get back up to that level of savings.
Lastly, what would you say is the best and the worst financial advice you ever received?
Yes, I think the best and worst kind of comes hand in hand. The best advice I ever received was to save first and spend after. I look at how many people say that, it's fine, I earn more than I spend, therefore I'll just save what I have left at the month. Unfortunately, we live in a world where your big corporates are spending billions of dollars on advertising just to try and get us to separate with our spare cash. So, the best advice and my motto is to save first with a debit order as your salary comes into your account, and then you can spend the rest of your money completely guilt-free.
So it sort of becomes an expense almost that you've budgeted
for. Yes, exactly.
That was Devon Card, a director and shareholder at Crew Invest.